In 2008, he was awarded Australian Actuary of the Year, and in 2009, he officially became Actuary of Yesteryear. Please welcome Darren Wickham.
Thank you for that kind introduction, Melinda. Now, today I only have three slides, but I hope to speak reasonably briefly on financial condition reports. And in particular, I'd like to talk about why have financial condition reports for super funds? What is a financial condition report? What is financial condition? What should be included in a financial condition report? And where do we go from here? So I'm only going to spend hopefully no more than 15 minutes talking, and I'd really like to throw it open for discussion for your ideas, because what I'm putting up today is just initial suggestions, and I'm sure as a profession we can develop and improve these ideas to develop a useful service for the superannuation industry. Now, before I start talking about financial condition reports, I'd like to issue a brief apology and then do something silly. Now, firstly, my apology. My boss, Martin Stevenson, is presenting at one of the other concurrent sessions at the moment. So, Martin, if you're listening to this audio, now you know why I didn't turn up to your session. Although you didn't turn up to mine. Now, secondly, I'd like to do something silly. It's been a long day, and this is the last concurrent session for the day. So before I get stuck into financial condition reports, I'd like to show you a video that was deemed a bit too naughty for an ASFA lunch recently. But firstly, why have financial condition reports for super funds? Well, public offer super funds, whether they're industry funds, large corporate funds, public sector, master trusts, are all evolving into complex financial services organisations in their own right. Industry funds really are the new mutual. They're the AMPs of 50 and 60 years ago. The assets and revenue of many of these funds exceeds, and sometimes substantially exceeds, many mid-sized life insurance companies. And most large funds are open to the public. Their trustees are running financial planning businesses. They're managing reserves. They're developing post-retirement products. And it wouldn't be too far a stretch to imagine in the near future that funds start insuring their own life risk. They get life licences. So with this evolution comes increased complexity and increased risk. And one proven idea to help directors and fund and executives manage this risk is to introduce financial condition reports. And what I'm talking about here is not just for defined benefit funds, it is for all superannuation funds, including accumulation funds. And as actuaries well know, these reports play an important role in other areas of the financial services industry, general insurance, life insurance, health insurance, and friendly societies. And currently around 20% of the assets in super are covered by a regulatory environment which requires a financial condition report, because around 20% of the industry's assets are invested in life insurance statutory funds. And also, this is not a theoretical concept for super funds who aren't insurers. Last year, NGS Super, a medium-sized industry fund, was the first fund, we understand, to undertake a financial condition report process. They road-tested the idea and presented the results at the ASFA conference, and the feedback was very, very positive from that experience. And so certainly by the end of this year, I speculate that there'll be several large funds that will have undergone this process. So what is a financial condition report? Well, in my suggestion, which I'm interested in your views, is that essentially it would have the same theme as those financial condition reports in life insurance, health insurance and GI. And that is, it's a report that provides an objective assessment of the overall financial condition or financial strength of the entity. And secondly, it provides an assessment of the material risks and the issues impacting on the financial strength of the fund. So here's my first slide. So what does financial strength or financial condition of a super fund actually mean? Well, my suggested view is that a financial condition is a measure of the fund's ability to withstand a risk event. And in a super fund, the things that affect how the ability of a fund to withstand risk include the level of reserves held by a fund, including operational risk reserves, the business strategy of the fund, the financial strength of the trustee, and also the major service providers of the fund. And by financial strength, we take into account things like the level of capital held, the contractual limits of liability with any service provider, and the degree that there's professional indemnity insurance that's held. Other aspects of that affect financial condition include the strength of any employer covenant, and that's important for a defined benefit fund. And this is all on a bedrock of sound risk management. Now, I'm not sure. There was actually a little pillar diagram there which seems to have not translated to the slide. But one other area that could be argued is important for financial condition is liquidity. Does the fund have adequate liquidity? So, and certainly these things are up for discussion and debate. So what things might you expect to be included in a financial condition report for a super fund? Well, I think there will be a lot of discussion between the amongst the profession and amongst the industry at large and the regulator, because everyone has slightly different views. But in the meantime, I'd suggest that there are six things that we'd include. And the first is an assessment of the financial condition at the balance date of the report. And secondly, an assessment of the change in the financial strength over the year and the reasons for that change. And that can be quite illuminating, why the reserves have gone up and down. That's an important part of it. And the third component is an assessment of the financial condition into the future. And to do that, and that involves some modelling of the fund and its reserves. And I'd suggest that would involve doing some analysis of member behaviour to build up a model to project forward cash flows, to project forward assets, membership, fee revenue and expenses, and do all of that, and looking at the numbers, to examine the sustainability of a fund's fee basis and how the reserves build up in the future. Now, the member behaviour analysis is quite interesting in its own as an exercise, and I'd suggest that we apply the techniques that we've always used in large defined benefit funds. Just apply those to accumulation funds. So, for example, we look at the rates at which members leave a fund for different ages and different durations. We look at the rates at which members become active and inactive. We look at how members are taking up pensions and how different groups contribute to the fund. And certainly ASFA's recent best practice paper on liquidity suggested that we do such projections to understand the impact on future cash flows and liquidity requirements. So that was the third thing that I suggested include, a projection of the financial condition into the future. The fourth thing is a subjective review of a fund's risk management framework, and I'll come back to that separately. The fifth thing that I suggest is that we actually do an experience analysis of a fund's risk events during the year and compliance failures to help build up a model to perhaps model operational risk and other things. And finally, I'd suggest that we do a deep dive into some selected risks that are particularly important for funds, for example, unit pricing or liquidity. Now, as I mentioned, I'd suggest be included is a subjective review of a fund's risk management framework. And you might ask, well, aren't risk management frameworks already audited by the accounting audit process? And the answer is, well, yes, they are, but the accounting audit and a financial condition report cover two completely different things. And in life insurance, GI and health, there is an accounting audit of the risk management framework and an actuarial review of it as well. And the accounting audit focuses on the compliance with the risk management statement framework. It doesn't necessarily question the validity of the framework, whereas the financial condition report will look at it and say, does that make sense? And possibly a financial condition report would also benchmark the framework to an industry best practice or an industry standard. And to flesh that example out, if a fund's risk management framework had as an example that to control unit pricing errors, we'll make sure that all custodians wear pink shirts. What the accounting audit will go through and do is it will tick off that, yes, the custodians are in fact wearing pink shirts, whereas the financial condition report, on the other hand, would actually say, well, that's not a very useful control. Perhaps they should be wearing Superman outfits instead. Now, funds might ask, well, the bigger funds in particular might ask, well, why should we do this? Because we're doing some of this work already. And that's true. Large funds are doing this work in different areas of the fund executive, or bits of it at least. But certainly I think there's real benefit in pulling all of this work together and looking at it into its entirety, because sometimes you can see risks much better when you have a top view and you aggregate all of those little things, patterns emerges. And I think also for directors of funds that aren't involved in the day-to-day executive management of an industry fund or a large public offer fund, the directors don't often see bits and pieces of that work being done. So it's quite useful to pull that together for the directors to see what's happening. And certainly I think the report provides a structure and a regularity of doing this and a bit of a discipline. And so I think that has a spin-off benefit of being a basis for comparing the results over time. So what is the... Now I get on to my second slide. So what is the value proposition? Why would a trustee board or a fund executive engage an actuary or possibly somebody else to do a financial condition report? And it's usually a trustee board, and in particular the Risk Audit and Finance Committee of a trustee board that would commission these reports. So why would they do it? And I think there's a few reasons. The first is that, you know, the funds have become sophisticated and are a financial services organisation, and this is a type of reporting that you would expect to see and would be useful and provide insights for the management of a large organisation. I think it also, the second argument for it is that it provides a level of comfort to the directors and the executives that the risks are being appropriately managed, particularly if there's a deep dive into the material risks faced by the fund. I think it provides useful insights into the operation of the fund, but also useful insights into member behaviour. And that's, I think, quite attractive, particularly for funds that are spending big dollars on marketing and communication. Are they getting bang for their buck in targeting different groups? What the member behaviour does, it gives you a baseline of behaviour to compare and assess the impact of those, say, member communication campaigns over time, and to see those trends emerge in a longitudinal way is quite powerful. And I think the modelling is very useful for setting reserves, for the business planning, the business side of running a fund, setting the fees, and dictating, you know, looking at how big the fund is, will it have economies of scale, should we merge? It leads to quite a strategic discussion. I think the reports would be extremely useful in a due diligence situation for mergers of funds. But there is a view, and I certainly acknowledge that, and maybe this is a question that we'll have later, that the reports are best done where there's an ongoing relationship with the fund instead of a once-off, but we can talk about that. And certainly I would speculate that that doing a financial condition report wouldn't hurt, wouldn't do anything to harm your perception in the eyes of the regulator. I imagine that if a fund took the initiative to show it was managing its risk well, then I'm not speaking for APRA, but I imagine that would be reasonably an impressive step. So I think it's instructive to consider what happened in general insurance in 2005. In 2005, we had the HIH Royal Commission, and following that, there was a suite of reforms that, part of that regulatory reform was the introduction of financial condition reports for general insurance companies. And APRA's observation of the introduction of those reforms is quite interesting. That directors of the general insurance companies were quite supportive of the APRA requirements because it gave better insights into their business, particularly and especially from the actuary's financial condition report. So the value proposition, I think, we can articulate. And certainly while I think there is an additional cost for a fund in doing this, I think it has to be weighed up with the potential savings that that might flow from the early detection of some of the problems that can be quite costly down the track. And certainly in going through this process, I've seen things, unit pricing and tax and administration errors that have been identified that certainly would, if they weren't dealt with now, would have cost the fund a lot of money. So where to next? A number of organisations, including the Institute, suggested to the Cooper Review that there should be some encouragement or perhaps mandating of financial condition reports. And certainly I can see reasons why APRA might feel that the introduction is beneficial, because it does provide an expert review of a fund that pulls together all of the different elements of APRA's prudential practice guides and puts it into one document. And certainly it provides a sound methodology for the testing of risk management frameworks and for the establishment of reserves, the monitoring of reserves. So I can see why APRA might like it. I can see why funds might like it. But my own personal view is that this is an idea that it does provide funds, trustees and executives with useful insights into the operation of their fund. And I think it does provide a level of comfort about risks, and therefore it's ultimately a benefit to fund members. So that's all I really wanted to say, and I'm more interested in your views, so I'll hand it over.
Okay, we have Katrina coming around with a roving mic, so if you'd like to ask a question, please just state your name and where you're from. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Andrew Wakeling. I'm not quite sure where I'm from. I'd like to pick you up on your point about the new mutuals and the lessons we might actually take from the old mutuals. I'd like to suggest that if we can get a report in on this sort of basis, that we should try and make a section of it fundamentally on corporate governance and security of the operation. So this is where the real issues were that we may have failed on with the mutuals. The general joke with mutuals as to what were they for was, well, of course, they're for management. And the cynicism ultimately proved to be quite damaging. The question is growth good? Who's it good for? Is biggest best? Why and for whom? Should the entity estate, that pool of money which we probably need to run the business but which can't be attributed to any of the current members, should it be protected from their thieving mitts, as we might say? Do future members have an interest? course, we all like to say in these mutuals, there's nothing more than the chairman of mutuals like to say that, you know, they're an institution for the benefit of society. Do future members have an interest, and if so, who speaks for them? The lesson that I think we can take from our experience, actuaries in mutuals, particularly, I have to say, the mutuals in the UK, is that the vagueness and unwillingness to address these issues in the UK mutuals proved ultimately to be incredibly damaging and even corrupting. Do you think we can catch this in the new mutuals before it actually goes the same way?
It's a very interesting point of view. Does anyone else have I don't have a particularly good answer to that. Does anyone have a view?
I think the proposition. Stop. Okay, it's Peter Beck from Pillar. My history is more interesting than where I work now in terms of this question. I worked for a mutual colonial for a long, long time and went through the demutualisation. I think fundamentally where mutuals went wrong was not separating out, I guess, capital for the company from the company itself or the shareholders' funds. And it took a long time through torturous processes to eventually separate out the capital for running the company from, I guess, the funds. Mm. So I think probably the lesson for me is that industry funds need to start thinking that way too. Mm. I might just share the general insurance experience too. I was on the Financial Condition Report Institute subcommittee before HIH failure. And I've got to say, there was absolutely no appetite in the industry at all for financial condition reports until there was a failure, and that suddenly changed everyone's view. Mm. So I'm hoping we don't have to have a failure before people get enthusiasm for your idea.
Mm. So I might just throw a question in for Peter. So do you think it's going to be better to mandate them, or do you think it'll be better to encourage, you know, to show clients the value proposition and have them adopt them on a voluntary basis? Because there's some argument that if you mandate it, it becomes a box-ticking exercise and it sort of adds less value.
I think it's an interesting question. And it's kind of, unless it's mandated, you've got no choice but to try and sell it. So we're in the selling stage right now. I've got to say, in the general insurance, the selling was singularly unsuccessful. It was seen as a takeover by actuaries. General insurance industry was run by a lot of people who weren't actuaries. And the kind of view was, well, we know what we're doing, so why do we need you guys? Mm. I think if we position ourselves correctly as the expert that helps them, not a takeover, I mean, and that's what it's going to look like. It looks like a takeover. Mm. And so we need to be very delicate in terms of how we sell this. Mm. Into the industry. My own view, I don't think we're going to get traction without compulsion. It just didn't happen in the general insurance. It may have if we'd kept going, but fortunately or unfortunately, whichever way you look at it, when HIH failed, the regulations which were ready to go, which everyone said was impossible to put in you know, less than 2 to 3 years, was in about 6 months. So nothing like a failure to prompt people into action.
Yeah. I mean, that's an excellent point. Actuaries don't have an automatic monopoly in this space. I guess we've been quite careful at this stage not to suggest that this is an actuarial financial condition report. Certainly, I think we've got very good skills and qualifications, but other people disagree. I mean, do actuaries have the necessary skills? I remember that during the general insurance debate about financial condition reports, there was some concern that actuaries didn't necessarily have the ability to be across all of the different areas of general insurance companies' operations. It may not have understood underwriting and a few things like that, and therefore, can an actuary really comment on a risk management framework? Are there other people more better qualified? So, throw that open.
Rhonda Virtue from PFS. As a non-actuary, perhaps I'm well placed to say that I would be very keen to see, but as a specialist in group insurance, very keen to see insurance included in that report. And I suppose I was a little bit surprised to be sitting in with a whole bunch of actuaries and the word insurance didn't come up in regard to the operational risk of insurance, which I don't think trustees quite realise there is there. And I would be looking to an actuary to assist me to with that report. So I think there's a good mix there.
Yeah, and certainly I should say that the financial condition report does, isn't, well, my view of it, should cover all aspects of the fund, including insurance, particularly where there's self-insurance, but also just the operational aspects of insurance.
And systems that don't have, you know, they're struggling to manage basic group insurance, let alone the sophistication that's coming through with these massive amounts of insurance cover being provided automatically.
And certainly what one benefit of doing member decrement type analysis, member behaviour analysis, is you also get death and TPD experience rates out of doing that analysis, and you can compare that against your insurance premiums in the fund to see, you know, is the experience better or worse than the claims experience better and worse than you expected? Are there areas of, say, disability risk that are emerging?
So. Lawrence Heyman, I'm for a industry fund, Health Soup. Just on the mutuals, I think industry funds are a little bit inoculated against carpet bagging in that they don't have big capital reserves. And I thought originally a lot of them set up with a corporate structure that doesn't give members ownership rights in the same way that mutuals had. I've got two questions. With financial condition reports, say, for life insurers, generally they've been done by actuaries within companies, and that's probably not feasible for industry funds. And do you think that will take away from them? I forgot my second question, so maybe if you could take that one and I might think of it.
Yeah, I will. There are a number of industry funds that do employ actuaries, and I think there's a couple in the room. So I think that is increasingly common. Now, in general insurance, not all general insurers, the actuary doing the financial condition report might work for a consultant, and I think that's the predominant case still. So there can be that outsource model. There are advantages and disadvantages in both approaches. I might just make an observation of the mutual issue. There has been a couple of cases of demutualisation of industry funds, admittedly the quasi-industry funds. I think the accountant, the super fund, was sold, and in the end the members didn't have an entitlement, so you're right, the corporate structure didn't permit the refund of the sale price to members, I think. Because the proceeds ultimately went to the shareholders of the trustee company. But it would be interesting to see it'd be entirely possible for industry funds to change the structure again of their trustee company to perhaps own their own shares or something like that, to become a true mutual. And the other point is, I guess, that the capital reserves have been low, but they are building. Then certainly most funds are now holding operational risk reserves in the order of at least 50 or more basis points. And for a large industry fund like yours, I think that translates into big dollars. And there's a debate about whether it could be held outside the fund in the trustee company itself, and certainly trustees could levy the fund to take the money out of the fund and into a trustee company. But there's interesting tax disadvantages in doing that. Trustees pay corporate tax often, and there are GST issues around that as well. So.
I've thought of my second question. life insurers and general insurers, it's quite obvious what happens, that they can go broke when they can't pay their claims, for instance. I guess for super funds, what does failure really look like, and does that weaken the argument for FCRs, even though I'm in favour of them?
Yes, I mean, they can go broke because there's a minimum level of assets that they have to hold, because there's a statutory requirement for capital adequacy and solvency. And we have a vested benefits solvency standard and a technical insolvency for DB. I guess failure, it's true that a lot of operational risk can ultimately be passed on to members. If you have a big unit pricing error, you can pass that on to members, but there's enormous potential damage to your brand, and I'd suggest that having your name splashed all over a current affair, that we haven't had a run on a super fund in Australia, but it's not beyond the realms of possibility. And if you're a fund that has a large amount of illiquid assets, then suddenly you do have a failure problem because you can't pay your money out. So I think there is ways, there's failure, but it's not as clear-cut as in life because we don't have those standards.
I guess that's the point I was trying to make, is that you can't see a failure if you don't separate out the capital from the funds. Mutuals just used to dip into the shareholders' funds whenever they had a problem, and so we've got the same situation. You can't actually see industry funds dipping into the funds because they're just exceeding their fees. They just take it out of the fund. So as soon as you start separating out the capital from the funds, you actually can see these things much more easily. And then you can, you know, then there is kind of a definition of failure, if you like, in a super fund. Just to pick up the point about should actuaries do this stuff, are we the experts? You know, do we know everything about everything? Are we super actuaries? I think that's coming from the wrong point of view. I think our skill is that we've got a holistic point of view. We can actually see the big picture. We can see a lot of the pieces or components. If you go back to life insurance, we're not experts on underwriting either. We rely on underwriters to do underwriting. So this same issue came up in the general insurance space. We're not the experts, so why are we doing these reports? There's nothing wrong with doing a report which relies on other experts to give advice in terms of what you're putting into your financial condition report. So, you know, in life insurance, you look at what your audit people are telling you, look what your risk management people are telling you. This report, the idea of it is it's a holistic report. It takes an end-to-end view, and it brings together, if you like, the components of the business. And I think that is a job we should put our hands up for.
Alan Doble. I've been a big fan of a lot of your work, Darren, but I'm not convinced by this one, I have to say. Somebody's got to speak against it, I suppose. What can actually go wrong? Most of this stuff, I think, industry fund can be pretty much a shell organisation. So it's outsourced administration, it's outsourced investment management. The investment manager might have the unit pricing problem or the liquidity problem, but the fund itself doesn't have to have. It can do the management internally if it wants. They do have an issue with record keeping. Again, they probably have outsourced the systems management. If that goes wrong, it could go seriously wrong, and they may have a problem there, but the audit then is of the service provider. It's not a financial condition report, I would have thought, on the superannuation fund itself. I was pleased to hear you say that these industry funds now have some reserves and capital, because that was always a bit of an issue, that if everything was being passed back to members as they started off doing as a completely mutual organisation in their early days, then something can go wrong. You know, they're handling big amounts of money, there's lots of cash flows, there's always a chance of some sort of fraud or theft, and the nature of those is that it's always something unexpected, that someone's done something they shouldn't have done and no one's thought that that might happen. So they can get away with it. Can we, and I suppose really the question is this a job for actuaries or is it a job that needs doing at all? There's almost a need, but I'm just not quite sure that we've got the sales pitch right yet. Mm. So if we as the Institute are trying to put this forward, as I think we did to the Cooper Committee, I think the evidence needs to be stronger than we've presented so far. Mm.
Thanks, Alan. And look, I take your point and about the being a virtual organisation, a lot of outsourcing. And initially I was of that view too, that super funds started out often as virtual organisations. Everything's outsourced. And one experience I had was with an industry fund that had a major unit pricing error. It was in the custodian space, because custodians often do most of the unit pricing now. In the end, the error wasn't huge. They managed to rectify it. There's rectification cost, but it didn't cost members a lot because of the way it was rectified. But the trustee looked at its agreement with the custodian, and this is a multi-billion dollar fund. It was potentially, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in error, and the agreement with the custodian had a limit of liability of $2 million. So I take your point. There's virtualisation, but and PI cover doesn't only go so far as well. So I think there's a protection in place, but I think there is a need for something a bit stronger. But that's my view, and I'm certainly interested.
Ken Griffin, just to Alan's comments, because I guess I've got a similar view. I think we've got to be careful. First of all, for funds which are becoming such a centrepiece for the in terms of politics here in Australia and ultimately the retirement savings of people, I think not to have something on the financial health of those entities would be a mistake. In other words, I think from that perspective, financial condition reports have a real role. I think the contents of that report, though, is more the discussion and who does it. If you look at the life insurance industry, for rightly or wrongly, the actuaries had a strong role there because principally the key risks have been around understanding the pricing of long-term products, understanding the reserving for those long-term products, and capital, if you like, as being the key way of managing that risk. I guess I don't see the same characteristics in the superannuation industry. I see, whether you call it a virtual entity, you see an entity that is predominantly exposed to operational risk and counterparty risk. So even to the extent you've got a defined benefit fund, you're effectively, you have a lender, you have a funder of last resort, which is the employer, and you're exposed to the counterparty risk on that employer. To the extent that an actuary has skills to be able to assess operational risk and counterparty risk, I think they become a strong candidate to do the financial condition report, but what's probably more important is to have someone with those skills doing it necessarily than labelling it to a specific profession. Mm. I think what we've got to be careful of is we don't sort of naturally fall back on capital as the way to manage risks in the superannuation industry. I agree that you've got an evolution here of a mutual society through industry funds, but they're not necessarily the same sort of structures as we had with life companies 10 or 20 years ago, and capital isn't the obvious way to actually manage the risk. Operational controls, operational processes are going to be much more important, and therefore if we've got the skills to look at those sort of things, great, but other professions also have those skills as well.
And that's a good point. APRA have stated publicly before that risk management is as important as capital in superannuation. I think that was on the record of being said. Now, actuaries arguably aren't experts, actuaries working in super haven't been experts in operational risk. I note that the Institute has recently launched its Chartered Enterprise Risk Actuary qualification, which I think would be very useful for actuaries performing work, doing work in this space. Banks are very good at operational risk. They've got a lot of experience. They do their internal capital adequacy assessment process, and as part of that, there's a lot of focus on things like that. I think we're at the beginning of that whole type of field of endeavour in superannuation, and I'd suggest that at the moment, nobody really has a very good handle on the nature of operational risks. Nobody can really model well operational risks in superannuation.
Got time for one or two more questions or comments?
Thanks. I'm concerned that anything that we might do might in fact actually encourage a line of thought that industry funds need more capital as their prime solution. If we do that without addressing the issue of who owns that capital, how is it rewarded, how is it managed, how are decisions made related to it, because it seems to be an absolute open invitation to corruption. I think the industry funds, certainly the industry funds that I've dealt with, have been absolutely inspiring in terms of the people who've run them, who've typically a meeting late at night and all sorts of committees. They haven't joined those funds to make themselves rich. They have traditionally been very very poorly paid. But of course, that's exactly how life insurance mutuals started. They didn't start on the basis of making anybody rich. So corporate governance is absolutely crucial. I don't think it's actually in the interests of a mutual organisation to build up capital. I don't think if one was running, for instance, a consulting practice, that you'd want to own the property, because you've got the problem of how the heck do you pass it on? How do new partners buy in? I think naturally one wants to minimise the amount of capital related to the business. So if we can help industry funds establish how they contract with outside parties to secure the insurance related to unit pricing errors rather than putting up capital, to actually make them as efficient as possible so that one can say, in effect, the industry fund has the money is the money of the members. I think even so, it would be wise for us in advising industry funds to talk to them about their corporate governance. Well, you know, it is important that we know how organisations, which are so important as industry funds, how they in fact are accountable.
Do we have one last question?
Hi, I'm Barry Dillon from PricewaterhouseCoopers. I think you mentioned during your presentation that you already presented this at an ASFA conference, and I guess there's mixed impressions around the room here with us actuaries on whether or not it should exist in NFCR. What was the general impression at that conference?
I think there was a bit of self-selection at that session, because the people that were interested in financial condition reports generally tended to be in favour of them, and so I got positive feedback after that. Maybe that was because Anthony Robwell-Ball from NGS Super was speaking, and he was very positive about the reports. But I understand in the industry that this is not sort of universally accepted. I think there's a big there's a debate to occur whether or not people see value in doing this, and it's not universal. Any last minute? I think we're running out of time for one last question. Okay.
Well, thank you, Darren. Please join me in thanking Darren. A very insightful presentation, and I think an interesting discussion. It's certainly a controversial issue, but I think a lot of good points have been raised. So, thank you very much. Thank you.